If your podcast produces like ourselves, then you know it's not easy finding the right sound effects. We get ours from Smackheads. For useful podcast sound effects, visit smackheads.com. The Right Space is supported by Rode Microphones. For professional sounding audio, visit Rode.com.
Jacqueline, thank you so much for coming on The Right Space.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, welcome.
Before we do start, I did want to point out that the work that you do is quite
stunning.
Beautiful, stunning, mesmerizing, and unique.
Like, thank you.
I don't think there's things I've seen that has, you know, that kind of description in my mind.
But yeah, book sculptor.
Yeah. Yeah.
There aren't many of you. Yeah. You've definitely got a niche there. I agree with Linda. The work is absolutely stunning. I mean, we're looking at, that's your profile picture on the Skype.
Oh, yes. That's a piece called Pod.
Okay.
Okay. And was that a book in its former life? Yes.
Several books.
Yes, it was actually two books. It was actually a combination of part of a Buddhist, a book on Buddhism, and a children's book.
Wow.
And so when it came together, it was kind of like, I was holding it up sort of like this universal thing that felt like, you know, to become a Buddhist, you have to become like a child. So these kinds of ideas were sort of floating around in the work. So, yeah, it kind of looks like lace a little bit in that picture.
It does.
It looks very different according to how it's handled. But I like the idea that it was like a book that you could sort of see through, and you didn't know it was a book until you actually encountered it close up.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay, back to my first question. What is your relationship to your space?
Okay, so my studio space. I actually work in my house. I have a wonderful room with very high ceilings and windows that is my very own studio space. And I suppose my relationship to it is just that it's like a creative sanctuary for me. Mm-hmm. It's my play space. Mm-hmm. It's a very special space. It's very beautiful. The light is just beautiful in it. I suppose I feel like I'm embraced and enveloped by it. You know, when I go in there, it's a very special space where pretty much all my magic happens, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the only space that I use to make artwork.
Oh, okay. What other spaces have you got?
Well, it depends on what I'm making, but I also have a very, very, very large kind of garage space that opens out to sort of like a bamboo area. It's sort of hard to describe because you can drive underneath my house.
Oh,
so
okay.
You go up a driveway and you drive underneath my house. And when you come up into the house and in my studio, I'm kind of at the level of the treetops a little bit, sort of like I'm in a little tree house.
Yeah, right.
I remember that in the photos. Yeah, we can see that.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And so then when you go down, there's also the garage space where I can do larger works and where I can also go outside. So when I'm dealing with a larger scale in my work, I will go down there. So I kind of hop around from my usual space, which is inside my house, and down outside. I have quite a bit of space to work with, depending on what it is that I'm working with.
Lucky you. Gosh, that sounds amazing.
Yes, I am lucky.
Yeah, especially with having the treetops there at eye level. That's just like being in paradise.
Yes, it is. We have, I should say my husband built our house about 6 years ago. So I didn't always have this space. We live on an acre in the country here in Hawaii, which is stunningly beautiful.
Wow.
I have this beautiful shower tree outside, you know, my studio where I work. So
sounds magical.
It's pretty nice. Yeah.
Wait, so was that a shower you said you have outside?
A shower tree. Is that like a pink shower tree? Kind of looks like well, I don't know if it really looks like a cherry blossom, but it's beautiful pink. It's very fragrant. It hangs over massive boughs. All the birds play in the branches. serenade me while I'm working. It's wonderful.
That's wonderful. Wow. Gosh.
Yeah.
That is a little slice of paradise.
It is. It is. So here's a hard question. Is there a particular part that you love most, or like, is there something that you just absolutely have to have in your space?
I think what I really love most of all about this space is that it's a space of my own.
Right.
You know, because when I grew up, I'm actually from Northern Ireland originally, and I am the youngest of 9 children.
Wow. I think you mentioned that last time we spoke, and I gasped even then.
Yeah, even until I was a teenager, I didn't even have a room of my own, you know, so I didn't have a space of my own. So to have a space of my own is just really special for me.
So
that's like a big deal for me to have that sort of special space where I can operate creatively. And actually, just while we're on the subject of space, I was thinking a lot about, you know, what is a studio space? What is a studio? And I think that a studio can be anything to an artist. I think that a studio can be anywhere. And in fact, it could be on the internet. It could be in your mind and you, how you project your thoughts and your ideas onto the space and so forth. There's an interaction there. So I'm lucky to have this space, but I could work in any space. You know, you could put me in a little box and I'd find a way to be creative, you know.
I like the thought that a space could be anywhere. It could be the internet. It could be your mind. I think that's very true. It's where.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, as artists, we're very creative and we have to be adaptable to our environment and what we get. Living in Hawaii, it's very expensive. You know, land is a premium. The price of properties are exorbitantly high. So many of the artists here have very unique challenges to finding spaces to work. But I am of the belief creatively that with limitation becomes even more creativity.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that you know what I mean? It sort of really narrows things down. It's sort of like the paperclip of space. It's sort of like, okay, what can I do in here with this space and how does it inform my work and how do I interact with the space? So, I feel a very special connection to my space. It's very intimate. It's beautiful. Linda, you asked me what did I like especially. I love the light in this space. It has this beautiful ambient light. Especially when it comes to the autumn and you start to see the light change in here in Hawaii, there's just sort of this beautiful amber filtered light that goes through the space. You know, I woke up this morning and the light in the space was just beautiful. And I feel embraced and bathed in it. And I really like that. It's nice. A very sort of special feeling and space for me.
It must bring you a lot of peace.
It does. It does. Although, you know, when I'm making my work, you know, it's a space that's always in flux. So there are peaceful moments and there are many moments of chaos.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Lots of chaos happens in there too. Don't be fooled.
I'm sure. Yeah. Well, that's good. Then you wouldn't be like, you know, creating if there wasn't a little bit of chaos and challenges.
No.
There. Yeah.
So, of course not.
So let me ask you, how would you describe your work to someone?
How would I describe my work?
Yeah.
Visually or conceptually?
Let's start with visually.
Yes.
And then let's go into conceptually.
Because we'd like to know both. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, what does it look like to you?
Well, they look like to us these kind of intricate, abstract, seductive sculptures. These really very, very unique we went through your website here. Let's bring up the website again. Oh, it was on your computer, because now we switched to my computer, but we can go on here. They just look indescribable.
But
in a good way, because you look at them and each one is so different and so unique. And there is an element of, I don't know, there's something a little erotic about them, a little bit seductive, a little sensual, because they've got these curves and circles and these sort of colors. There's the one, my favorite one is the black. It's all black. I think it's a charred book. And then you've got this sliver of red in the middle.
Oh, yes. I think I know which one you're talking about. Yes, I love those ones too.
Which can be, like, to me, it reminded me of a vagina, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Some of them look like maybe something that you're looking at, say, from thousands of feet up in the air. You ever get these aerial kind of photographs of the earth and the way the land or the water or different, you know, sort of masses make these interesting shapes, and that you think, God, only nature could do that, you know?
So there's sort of like a topographical aspect to them.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. And some of them look like food.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
You know, like puffed pastry or something.
Exactly.
So, and that's why I guess I wanted to know how you, the artist, would describe your work in general.
Okay. Well, I get all sorts of responses, and that's the beauty of the work. Mm-hmm. First of all, my main sort of agenda, I guess you could say, is that I'm interested in abstracting the book form.
Mm-hmm.
Because what makes it really interesting for me as an artist is to sort of lure the viewer into looking at an object and having them wonder what it is, and then finally sort of having that aha moment that it's a book, and that it's a book in which I have taken the book components, like the pages, the covers, the inks, the book headbands, and I've scrambled their formal arrangement and represented them to have a new
totally
narrative.
New. Yes, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the time I'm erasing content to create new content. It's a new narrative. So I'm really sort of forcing the viewer to have sort of an experiential reading of something and to sort of have an immersive experience for them, so that they have this kind of dialogue or kind of internal dialogue with a book that doesn't actually have words.
That's an excellent description, because that is exactly what you've done. You've taken one art form that's completely literary and cerebral and intellectual and turned it into another art form that is completely visual and abstract and, like, spiritual, you know, in a way.
Yeah,
although books
thank
can
you.
Be rather spiritual, yeah. Because now we're looking at, right now we're looking at... what's this one called? Can you read that? My eyesight is so bad.
Ethnologica?
Like
all right, hold on a second.
Oh, the title?
Yeah.
Yeah, Anthologia.
Anthologia. Which looks like a flower?
Yes, that's my glamour girl of my book sculptures. It's a very popular piece.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
It's so
thank you.
Beautiful, because it could be a flower, it could be a fruit. But it's a book.
Yes. It's actually a series of books. A lot of people think it's actually one book, but it's a series of actual Asian literary texts in which I have taken, hand-painted all of the pages with inks and folded the pages, manipulated them, put them together, sanded them, burnished. And, of course, you know, a lot of my work actually, there's an indication of maybe what the idea is in the title. And so Anthologia is, you know, a gathering of texts and so forth. So there's always some kind of a reference to the book and another story, but I try to always leave it open-ended, of course, because I think that what I'm really trying to do is create something that I'm trying to sort of get into the essence sometimes of the books that I'm using, or maybe I'm trying to sort of create an experiential object that is really the sort of the shape of ideas or thoughts that I have about something at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm always sort of trying to create something that's an embodiment of ideas or thoughts that are either related to the book or just to things that I'm thinking about or experiencing. And I'm almost like trying to make that concrete in some way, sort of take the internal world and make it physical and real, you know, and try to sort of analyze it.
Yeah. You know, years ago, I remember seeing the first book sculpture. I think it was probably 20 years ago, if not more, and thinking, wow, that's really cool. Who'd have thought to turn a book into a sculpture? Now, I think it was a guy who did it, and he used to just sort of take the books, kind of turn them inside out and fold them in the way a lot of your work has done. But that's all he did with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, like I said, 20 years ago. And then we come across your sculptures, and you have taken it to a whole other level.
Yeah.
Do you know the guy I'm talking about? Have you?
I don't know. There are some people who work with the book, some artists that I show with quite a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was someone like Doug Bube. It goes all the way back. I mean, it goes back to the 60s with a lot of the Fluxus movement. Mm-hmm. But they were more like working with books and commenting on the book or making books.
Yeah.
I was never really interested in that. I'm sort of lumped in sort of the category of a book artist, but I'm actually really just a sculptor who worked with the book form.
Yeah.
Now a lot of people are working with books, but I was working with books at a time when, I mean, this is sort of like you didn't even see this. I mean, the internet wasn't even like what it was now. You know what I mean? You didn't see book art. There was no such a thing as book art on the internet. I was just working by myself here in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. It started off as an accident in a way, but not an accident, because I actually used to write little stories and make poems and illustrate them when I was a kid. So there was always this sort of book thing in my life. But as an artist, I kind of came back to it.
Okay.
So when I was working with the book form, I was working with it as a way to sort of just express ideas that I had about things internally and the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some ways not having any other examples out there made me, you know, very innovative and original and unique, because I wasn't the kids today, you know, they get on the internet, they have a look and they say, okay, who's doing what? And I think
that's right.
We have, we're sort of overwhelmed with images, and I almost don't want to look anymore, you know, it's sort of like.
Yeah. Because then you can come up with your own thing. Well, I was going to say, like, it's such a niche. In terms of the art world, there are so many writers and photographers and filmmakers and painters and sculptors, but book sculpting has a sliver of that. It's like such a niche thing. So what's the why behind what you do? Like why go there? Just in your own words. I mean, I think I know why, but see here.
Well, I mean, I think as an artist, we don't always really know why. I mean, I think I think on a very basic level, to answer your question, as an artist, what we're basically trying to do is we're just trying to take an object or a material and transform the mundane into something else that's, you know, wonderful or amazing or thought-provoking in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're all trying to get at the essence of something.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I really liked the idea of a book as an iconic, symbolic, cultural object or artifact, depending on which way you want to look at it, and sort of mine that as my medium. Because to me, I kind of feel like I'm writing visually.
Mm. Okay.
I kind of feel like I'm writing in a way, but I'm not using words.
Right.
So
you're like telling us, do you feel like you're telling a story with each sculpt?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Anthologia, what's the story that one is? I think you did tell us, actually. You told us what that represented.
Well, that particular one, it was sort of just referencing, I don't know if I had a particular story in mind other than it sort of referenced the actual Asian texts that it was made out of. Because I did another floral piece that was inspired by Japanese kimono forms that you will, living in Hawaii, it's a very multicultural place. And so there's a lot of Asian textbooks and things that I can get hold of that are very interesting visually, but also confusing because I don't exactly know sometimes what these works are about. So it's kind of interesting to take them and sort of work with them and try to express some of these ideas in different ways. Mm-hmm. But I think also too, if I look at my work, I mean, I've been doing this for about 18 years now.
Mm-hmm.
I think in some ways it's like a library of me, you know?
That's
you know, which I think all artists do. We're making something, we're trying to get to the essence of something.
Right.
And internal. For me, it was this very unique. Yeah, it was a very unique thing that I did. But I also have a background in ceramics, painting and drawing. And I also, you know, work with paint, and I'm working with paint right now, and I'm interested in doing things with paint and just trying to create a story with materials and in the case of the books, objects that already have a storyline and present it or put a twist on it.
Mm. So what's the most valuable thing that you've learned through your art about yourself or about life or creativity? Oh, what's the most valuable thing?
What's the most valuable thing that I've learned about being an artist or just?
Well, let's say, you say that for most artists, it's about getting to the essence, right? You want to create something that's thought-provoking, that brings, joy, life, new ideas to people who view your work.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a value in that. Or perceived value.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm just, curious. I'm always curious to know for each person what is the most valuable thing that they get out of doing what they do or the most valuable thing that they learn about themselves or about life.
Let's say
about life.
Well, yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, artists, I think being an artist can definitely sort of mimic life. There's one thing to be working in the studio, working by yourself, feeling very content or agitated maybe about a piece that's not working out or you're having difficulties with, or you're having those great aha moments when things are just working fantastic and you're really excited about the work. And I think one of the things that I've learned about being an artist is how it mimics life, and that is the roller coaster. Mm. There's a lot of ups and downs, and I'm someone, I'm very active physically. I like to do lots of sports and I like to exercise, and I think being an artist, to stay in it for the long haul, it's like being an athlete. You have all these ups and downs and you have to persevere. I think you have to be very persistent.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that I've learned about myself, especially when I think about myself as a little girl growing up in Northern Ireland and being a creative individual and the journey, the road I've taken to becoming the artist that I am today, is that you have to be really persistent. And a lot of artists in general are very sensitive people. Mm-hmm. And, we deal with a lot of these sort of sensitive thoughts and ideas about things and being vulnerable, sort of putting your soul into your work and having fragile moments. I think that even though I'm a very sensitive person, I've learned that I'm very resilient and, I'm not fragile.
Mm-hmm.
I persist.
Mm-hmm.
I keep exploring. I keep staying curious. It's just this natural inclination to explore and in curious and sort of live, I guess, an examined life, really, through your art.
Do you think that you would have arrived at that had you not been an artist? Do you think that?
Oh, yeah, I do. I mean, I think that if I wasn't an artist, I think I would have been an archaeologist or an anthropologist or something like that, because there was always this impulse in me, even when I was a child, and this stems from me being a child where I would always sort of go outside and I'd pretend to be like a little, bird watcher or an anthropologist or archaeologist. I would build things.
Mm-hmm.
I would do little studies of birds and books and make up names for them. I didn't even know what they were. I always had this impulse to explore. Yeah. So, I just have a very investigative personality. I have very active imagination. As a child, I was very shy. And so I think when, you're a creative, sort of shy individual, you've got a lot going on in your head. And so these things make themselves manifest in some way. And it's going to come out in some shape or form. Yeah. It just happens to be coming out through art.
Yeah. Well, hey, that's the best, I think, in my opinion, best of all worlds, because it could come out through like drug abuse, gluttony.
Yeah,
we wouldn't. So what are some of the challenges that you face in your work or as an artist?
I think the biggest challenge for me is sort of reconciling the inner world, the creative world of being an artist. And then there's the world out there, the business world of being an artist is tough. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a lot of ambivalence about the art world, the nature of the art world, how it works, how it can be sort of superficial, how it's, you built on, you know, production and the market and how as an artist you're supposed to fit into this, into these boxes and categories. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the challenges is for me, and I'm sure a lot of artists find this too, is that, you know, basically, and this is sort of a contemplation on what it's like to have a master's of fine arts in art. I think a lot of the universities, art schools are churning out students in art, and they're kind of churning them out to sort of make art that fits the marketplace and production. Nice. And for me, really, the way that I make art and how I'm inspired to make art doesn't fit neatly into that production model of, you know, having a show, say, in 1 year and having to have X amount of pieces for a gallery. You know, I don't really fit into that. And and that's, I think, the most challenging thing for me is that we're supposed to sort of fit into this sort of time frame of getting work out there. And
so sort of like the commercialization of art. Is that what you mean? The way, because I feel like a lot of sort of the art that you that kind of bubbles up is very fatty, you know, like it's the fad. It's like this is what's in now, and then again, I can't really bring to mind what the most recent trend in, and I guess all different genres, but I guess the most prevalent art forms are things like music and literature and you know, film, and that's where you see the fads, you know, where you see like okay, everybody wants cookbooks, you know, or the celebrity bio or something, and it's like, well, there's a lot of other really good stories out there that don't fall into those categories, but nobody's paying attention to them.
Exactly. There are a lot of stories that don't fit into those categories, and people, and art, of course, and you know, a lot of things after a while, anything can be converted commercial. You know, the most avant-garde piece of work can be, you know, like a performance art piece can be taped and, you know, made into a slick video or made into posters or photographs. So anything can be made commercial, but it's, you know, you definitely have to deal with the trends of art. And, you know, you're dealing with a lot of the sort of corporations that support artists that are working with very large projects, the money that's behind these things, the politics behind these things, and it can get very sort of convoluted very quickly and challenging, you know.
So how do you approach those challenges in your little neck of the woods?
Yeah, in my little neck of the woods. You know, it's funny because I had actually a lady who actually makes books from, her name is Arvel. She visited my studio from Australia, and she said to me, how is it that you live in Hawaii and you've actually become relatively well known for what you do in book art? And I said to her, you know, basically it's because I was just working the way that I was working. And it just so happened that for a while there, making art with books became a bit of a trend. And, you know, curators started contacting me. I got invited to shows, my show and museum shows. And so it sort of became like a thing, which was really kind of a little bit weird for me because it was sort of, I felt like it was my thing. You know what I mean? I mean, obviously there's lots of people work with lots of different materials. You can't be territorial over anything, but it sort of became weird because it became like this sort of private, meaningful thing that I did sort of became like a trendy thing, you know? And that's weird. I find that weird.
But in a way, maybe it's a little flattering too, because look, you've touched a nerve. You know what I mean? Like there's people, I mean, your work is really, it's beautiful. Every piece we look at, we think, wow, look at that. It can't, can it get any better? And it does. So good art does that. It starts off as your own, but if it's really sort of provocative and unique, then it becomes everybody's, right? Isn't that what you want?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's definitely, it's fair to say that my work has inspired a lot of work. And that's the way, you know, culture works.
Yeah.
It should be. Culture has to move forward. It can't be static. You know, someone's going to do something.
Can't be static.
Yeah, someone's going to do something, and then someone else is going to run with it and take it. And that's just the way the world works. And it, I tend to be of an experimental nature, and I'm also a bit of a contrarian. A part of me sort of wants to move on to the next thing. But, you know, I think it's always going to be there for me as something that is meaningful to me.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that I haven't mentioned that is particularly meaning to me to work with the books is that they also are often used books that belong to other people. Mm-hmm. So for me, there's sort of like the power or the energy of the people who own the pieces that are in the books too, which might sound weird, but I really that energy.
That's great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that probably adds to what we feel when we look at your work. I mean, like I looked at it, Linda and I were looking through your website and I was thinking, God, I wouldn't do that. I'm going to get a book. I'm going to go home and I'm going to try to fold my books into little, and then maybe paint them and see what happens. You know, they're very inspirational because what comes out at the end is just so different to anything that you see.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really, really beautiful. So yeah, back to where do you get most of your books from? Do people just donate them to you? Do you get stacks of books left outside of your studio, or
where do you get them? I do have people who sometimes email me and they'll say, you know, I have all these encyclopedias, etc., that I'd like to give you, mm-hmm. or you know, I'll have friends who. Actually, I have made art from some books that friends have given to me. Mm-hmm. But mostly, the very first time I actually started working with the books, and to go back to the start, was when I actually found an old dictionary that had been thrown into a dumpster when I was doing my MFA thesis. And essentially what I was doing was I was actually working very experimentally in clay. And I had made these sort of like 6 foot long root like pieces out of clay, because I was interested when I was working in ceramics and in doing something interesting with the material, that you know, like what is a piece of clay, what can we do with it, should it be a cup and saucer, etc. Mm-hmm. And I needed to put them into the kiln on pieces of wood, and I actually in the end became fascinated by how the wood burned. And so I just sort of made this connection. Oh, there's an old dictionary that was thrown out. Well, that kind of almost feels like a lump of wood. What will happen if I put that in the kiln? Mm-hmm. And that's how I started off with the work that I made called From My Ex Libris work in 2000, which was basically where I took books and I fired them in a kiln. Mm-hmm. And instead of them burning, as one would think, I actually worked for about 2 years to explore a process where I was able to actually kind of petrify them in mm-hmm. the kiln. Mm-hmm. So you would have some of them were sort of fragile pieces, and some of them were almost like coral, and some of them would self-glaze, and the books, you could tap them. It was amazing. So I was just interested in taking something and exploring it. So that was my first use of the book as an artwork, was in the dumpster, and then I decided to explore it more. Mm-hmm. And I got a lot of my books actually from the Friends of Kaneohe Library here, and also Kailua, which uh-huh. is basically the used books from the library. The community donates them, and there's an exchange, and you can buy them for about 25 cents or a quarter.
Oh, that's very good for you.
So yeah, that's essentially where I get most of my books. And I first started doing it, I wouldn't tell anybody what I was using them for, because, you know, even to this day, some people are a little bit judgmental about me using a book.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you that. Like, how do you feel about essentially taking these books and you now have rendered them, you know, unusable or unreadable? You know, I mean, you've taken, it's what we were talking about earlier. We've taken one art form and turned it into another. And,
right.
And there'll be these, you know, people out there who are book enthusiasts and think, that's sacrilege. Oh, my God, that's as bad as book burning. You know, you might as well go back to Nazi Germany for all you.
Yes, and I still get that.
Yeah.
Not really.
Well, the short answer would be is that I am actually preserving them in my own way. Mm. I feel like I'm preserving them. It's an often quoted sort of cliche quote now, but it's like giving new life to books. I mean, I think I said that years ago, but yes, as often said, giving new life to something that is actually usually thrown out. I mean, sort of, it's the librarian's dirty secret. You know, books are thrown out, they're put in trash landfills. Right. You know, I think they even use acids to break them down. Mm. A book is a multiple. You know, it's not like there's only one book in the world. It's a multiple, and there's this exchange where it can be used for many different things. Obviously, you know, for reading, for education, that's great. Mm. But there's also just a lot of old information out there in books and things like encyclopedias and dictionary, and just old information that isn't always relevant anymore either. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and the thing is too, and I think a lot of people misunderstand, I really love the book itself, the book form and what it stands for.
That actually shows, you know, it actually comes through.
I think so. Yeah. I think it does.
Because what you turn them into. Are there any books that you wouldn't ever defile?
Well, definitely. I would not touch the Quran for obvious reasons.
You'll get a fatwa.
Not
to joke about that.
That would just really not be a meaningful experience for me to do that in any way. And no, I wouldn't go there. And and then there's a book that I have from my father, a book on horses. It's one of the few things that I have from my father, you know, who died years ago. I have a little book from him. Those are the two books that I would not touch.
So would you do the Bible?
I may or I may have. I may or may have not.
Already? I think there's a little secret there. That's all right. Look, I don't have a problem with it.
No,
you know, there are Bibles in every hotel room all over the Western world. So there, it's not like there's a shortage of these books. Yes.
And actually, there will be more. I mean, there are lots of them.
Yeah.
You know, you have to understand, too, that as an artist, you know, when you're actually in making mode, you know, you go through this zone. And for me, because I'm very exploratory and experimental, when I was doing my MFA thesis to fire books and kilns, I mean, I spent 2 years researching materials, books, the dates they came from, the chemical properties of books. Did you know that there's actually clay particles in paper?
No, I didn't know.
Yeah.
But reading your website, and when you say that some, you know, different books come out with different textures after they've been through the kiln, that made me think, oh, there must be different, obviously there's different types and grades of paper, but clearly there's all kinds of other things in books that we have no idea about.
Yeah, there are different components in the books that actually contribute to how they turn out in the firing. But when I was making that work, I mean, you know, I don't want to say I was obsessed, but it was my job to be exploratory and very research-oriented into how books were firing, is my choice word, instead of burning, because that connotes something completely different. But so, I mean, you know, I was using whatever books that I could find at this point that were actually thrown out. A lot of books were thrown out.
Right.
Yeah. So it runs the gamut, right? All different kinds of books. So I wasn't interested necessarily in what type of books they were, because I was using it as a physical material to transform it into something else, to say something about the book, to say something, to say a new story that took another form, you know?
I see. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now I have one more question and I'm going to turn it over to Linda. I want to know, where is your kiln? Do you have a kiln in your studio or do you go somewhere?
Oh, no, I don't. I don't have a kiln anymore. I don't work with clay anymore. I mean, this was something that I did back in 2000 when I had, when I worked with facilities at the University of Hawaii at Manoa.
But don't you fire your books?
I have a Bachelor's of Fine Arts in ceramics. So I, you know, it's a process, it's a technique, a method. I could go back to at any time. I just became more interested in sort of doing other things and working with the books. And actually working with the books was a really good way for me to work with the material that was a little bit more low tech, but in ways I could still really express myself meaningfully through
it. Don't you fire your books in a kiln?
No, not anymore. No, which are you talking about the black ones?
Well, I assumed that they were all fired in the kiln to get.
No, they're not. No, that's interesting. No, only the ones from Ex Libris in 2000.
Okay.
Now let me explain. Yeah, the other ones, I think, but you know.
Okay, so for example, I'm looking right now at Cressier, which is a white covers with the red sort of pages inside, and it looks like a flowering kind of, that wasn't put through the kiln.
No, none of these works were. No, let me explain. The ones in 2000 were, but I used different processes and methods and techniques. basically what I do is I just utilize the components that you find in books. Mm. But because I scramble the arrangement of them, I'm also kind of doing a little bit of paper engineering. I'm actually looking to see how can I make a book, a piece of paper, you know, paper and text and cardboard. How can I make it stand up by itself and look like something completely different but still be a book? Mm. So the Cressier piece is actually a whole bunch of, I can't remember how many, they're actually encyclopedias that I took.
Did you like glue them together or?
What I did was I actually sliced some of the pages so that the book would go into a different slight shape. I then hand inked the pages. Mm-hmm. I then folded them, glued them together with archival glue as one unit. I then screwed those together. You can't see that they're screwed together. Mm-hmm. And then I made them into a form, and then I used a spiral book binding from another book to actually add to it to look like a vertebrae or spine.
Ah, okay.
So I'm just actually taking the books and I'm reconfiguring them and representing them completely.
Good. Well, that gives me hope. I don't need a kiln. If I ever wanted to try this, I could try something at home.
Yes, the thing is you have to think of the concept. And the thing is that it's doing it so that it looks seamless and simple. Yes. A lot of the things that I do with books, people do not understand how it is that I've made them that way. Yeah, and that's the beauty of it.
They're incredible.
Because a lot of people are really confused what they're looking at, and they are perplexed as how I get them to make them look the way they do.
Yeah,
you know. So even though I work a lot, I'm a process artist. I work with process a lot, methods and techniques. What I'm doing is actually very conceptual. I'm conceptualizing these ideas and making them manifest through just re-scrambling the book components.
They're just stunning.
They are stunning.
Right. On to you, Linda.
So you touched a little bit about your childhood. You were, what was it, one of nine kids? and space was...
Two half-brothers. Yeah.
And space wasn't a personal space, probably wasn't a big thing in your household when you were a kid.
Right. No, you're right. Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I grew up, well, of course you have to remember, you know, being the youngest of nine, a lot of my oldest brothers and sisters were a lot older than me. So it felt like having a whole bunch of different sets of parents, to be honest.
Right.
You know, because I had a lot of older brothers and sisters. So like, at any
like
one
how much
time,
older?
Gosh, let me see. Probably about maybe 20 years.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
So, but at any one time, there weren't that number of people living in the house. I mean, there were about maybe three to four of us. I mostly grew up with my brother and sister, Denise and Peter. But, you know, and I also grew up in the background of Northern Ireland, and I grew up during the Troubles. You know, there's the whole backdrop of, you know, coming from Northern Ireland, which, as you know, any of the sort of political history
I remember,
not always a cup of tea either. Mm-hmm. So space, I think when you grow up in a space where there's a lot of people or noise or things, activity, you know, for me, a sanctuary was to go outside, to be in nature. Mm-hmm. And also, I think your mind, you know, the creative space of your mind, that internal space and how you relate to the outside space is your sanctuary, you know? So I think that that was kind of like the place where, you know, I felt a lot of I guess you could say, what's the word? Calmness or contentless, you know, contentment.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd go outside and I'd do lots of things and I would write, I'd draw, I'd make things, you know, tree houses, you name it. I would go outside and I'd explore a lot. So
you were always creative as a child from the get-go.
Oh, absolutely. Even before I even went to school. I mean, I made like little villages out of, cardboard egg boxes. I made little houses out of matchsticks. Mm-hmm. I knit little things, you know, like little Humpty Dumpties and frogs. I mean, I would go to like the river beds and I would take out dirt and I would pretend it was clay and I'd make little bowls. I mean, I always made something, always. Mm. And my brothers and sisters too.
Right.
And it's not like we had a deprived existence or anything. We just had, you know, back in the day, you know, kids today are it's a very different world. You know, they can't go out and explore the world like we did. And so we just had, you know, adventures outside and using our imagination a lot and just, you know, building things from scratch. I just always had that incentive to make things, like creating my own world, you know. I guess taking my internal world and making it manifest in the things that I made. Yeah, definitely.
And do you think, like, that upbringing influenced your work today?
Oh, absolutely. I know I've had a very unique experience growing up in Northern Ireland. You know, I've traveled a lot. I think living in Hawaii is a very unique experience. And I think all of these things have really contributed to my work, you know, being sort of unique, because it doesn't really neatly fit into a lot of the, as you were saying, categories in the art world today. So I think it's been a blessing. I think it makes me unique. I mean, there are obviously things that I don't like about it, but absolutely. It's been an interesting journey for sure.
And I noticed that Borges is a big inspiration for you, is that right?
Well, not so much now, but when I was doing my thesis, you know, I was doing a lot of research and I was very interested in this concept of the library and sort of like the infinite world, the world inside our heads and the bigger world of the universe out there, you know?
Yeah, I love him, place in it. By the way.
Yeah, he's, you know, amazing. Like the Book of Sand, you know, like a book that changes its story when you open it. I mean, I just love shit like that, you know? It's just like so imaginative. I mean, it really was sort of a very compelling theme for me. So, I mean, it was, yes, then when I was doing my research, my thesis work and research, I was researching not just, you know, Borges, but just a whole bunch of different authors and things. And just sort of trying to also understand what it was that I was doing, you know, because when artists, you know, when we're working, we don't always really truthfully understand everything that it is that we're doing at the time. And it's in hindsight, we look back and we go, I really see that now.
That's almost the best part, you know?
Like it is.
When you look back and you realize, oh, this is what I've been doing, you know, or it crystallizes for you, then you've got, I don't know,
path. Yeah.
But anyway.
What else? Well, what else inspires you? You know, where else do you draw your inspirations from?
Well, definitely the natural world. As I say, materials, you know, working as an artist, I'm also interested in the history of materials, you know, and how they're interpreted in art history. So there's sort of like this personal explorative narrative going on in my head about what I think about things and how they're understood and interpreted out once, you know, you make an artwork and it's out there, you know, because I'm interested in this idea of how people project onto things and how that these books that I'm making are these sort of like, kind of experiential, how could you say, like Rorschachs, you know, like the Rorschach, you know, like, you know, that, you know what I'm talking about, you know, like when you see something and you sort of project onto it and, it's like people are projecting their own stories onto things. It's really interesting, you know?
That's a great way to describe it. The Rorschach, like an experiential I can never say that name. Rorschach.
I think it's Rorschach. I hope I'm saying it correctly.
I think
too.
You are. Yeah.
I'm kind of sort of making these Rorschachs, aren't I? Really?
Totally. They might become something that you see in like a psychiatrist's office is like a standard. You know? Tell us, what do you see here?
What's a Rorschach? I don't know what that is.
Back in the, when did they come out? Like 60s, 70s? They used to.
Yeah, I think it was in the 60s, right?
They'd have these like ink prints, right? That it looked like, you know, they put, you know, sort of paint on one side of the page, folded it like that, and then it had this mirror image, and then they'd hold it up and ask kids like, what do you see there? And there were a series of these kind of things. They were developed them was a Dr. Rorschach or something. They're called these Rorschach tests.
Her work
does look a lot like, because they're quite abstract, and the idea is you had to kind of, it gave the doctor a window into your mind, because let's say you saw, like somebody might say, that looks like, you know, a woman being stabbed, and then he can write his note, psychopath in the making, you know.
That's like your psychopath.
Or somebody else says, oh, it's flowers in a field, you know. Oh, normal, you know, or whatever it is. I think they've been found to be sort of BS now. I don't think people really rely on them anymore. They've kind of turned into a bit of a I don't know, maybe not.
I think I did that as a kid.
Yeah, I remember kind of looking at something like that, like in, I don't know, year one or kindy, I don't know. Exactly. But your work...
An artist would be off the scale completely.
Oh, totally, yeah. And your work would totally be off the scale. Like, if it ever came back, I would vote for your sculptures.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Yes, we could use those, exactly.
Definitely.
Like, sort of strange Rorschach palimpsest.
Yeah. Definitely.
Now,
all right, sorry.
Just moving back into the space, talk about the space. If the walls could talk, what stories would they tell us about Jacqueline Rushley?
If the walls could talk.
Yeah.
Inquiring minds want to know.
I am the walls.
That's great.
Nice answer.
These walls don't talk. You know, when I'm in the space, you know, I really feel like, and this goes back to what I was saying about what is a studio and what is a studio space. I think, you know, I think that if, for instance, if I lived in New York and I lived in Chelsea and I lived in one, you know, I made art in one of those massive sort of gallery spaces, I'd probably be making these huge works because, you know, you have this massive space to work with. Mm-hmm. And where I'm working is an intimate space and it's a space in my home. Mm-hmm. So I really feel kind of like the walls are like an exoskeleton, you know, it's sort of like an architectural, it's like the architectural space around me. It's like I'm the pulsating chamber, you know, it's like I'm in a chamber. I'm like the heartbeat of the space. I don't know. Does that sound weird?
No. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, you really do become one with the space, I suppose is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I love that. I love that concept.
Yeah.
I don't think we've actually had anyone, you know, because we ask all our artists that question. Mm. And we've had a range of answers, but I don't think we've ever had anyone say, I am the wall.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's great.
It is great. Yeah, it
welcome
is.
To my mind.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's actually an unusual question. I mean, if you think about the question, I mean, that's actually a difficult question. But in a way, it's sort of like, we become part of the space. I mean, to me, that answer is not really
that's
unusual.
Yeah.
We become part of the space. We become part of the materials that we work with because we work so intimately with materials. We work so intimately within a space. Mm. I mean, it's...
I guess
we
it's
inform
almost
it
like,
and it informs us.
Yeah.
Right?
I guess it's almost like we talk about space as a physical sense, but really what we really mean it's that space in your head.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
And how you, I guess, how do you, that's
sort of navigate.
Navigate.
Well, how
your
do
own
you
head.
Internalize the external?
Exactly.
That's life right there.
Right.
That's what we do every day, right? Because people, like Buddhists believe that all of life that we see is a projection. You know, everybody's got their own story. And like Linda's story, her world is different to my story and my world, you know. Like
yes.
That's so different to your world. Yeah.
And they even reckon, like even quantum physics has discovered that people move differently in time. Like for everybody, time is different. Some people move faster through time, some slower. My now is different to your now, and depending on the angles that we're at, and some people age at different paces. Some age slower than others. Others age much faster. So it's all so relative to the mind, you know.
Yes,
which I think is like just endlessly fascinating. And
that's, I think, also too why I was really attracted to books, because when you think about a book, it's an immersive experience reading a book and writing a book. And, you know, I mean, it's sort of like how you manifest your mind in within that structure, you know, which is just really interesting to me. And you, Roger, you're a writer, right?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure you have your own thoughts on books and what that, you know, that means to you.
Books are sacred to me. Like, I can't even bring myself
to
throw.
Oh, I need to get one of your books. Wouldn't that be interesting?
Oh, my God. You know what? The thought crossed my mind. I was thinking, I'll send her one of my books and maybe she'll do something with it. Yeah, that would be nice. I'd love that. Yeah. Well,
that could be an interesting collaboration, don't you think?
It could be. Yes. We'll have to talk. Definitely.
And have your people talk to my people.
Yeah. Yeah, so I agree with you. We're on the same page there. So where are we now?
So Jacqueline, I'm just curious in terms of let's sort of come back to the day to day of Jacqueline Rushlee. What is your typical day? You wake up in the morning. Do you have breakfast? Do you walk right into your studio? Talk us through your day.
Okay. Well, every day is different, of course, depending on what it is that I'm doing. I guess one of the things that I try to do is I try to have some kind of a steady way of working, developing good habits, I suppose, you know. I try to get up and have breakfast. Mostly I try to exercise every day. That's very important to me. I spend at least an hour doing some kind of an exercise to start off my day.
Oh, you must be so fit.
Well, I try to be. I could be a little better right now. But yeah, I think it's, you know, that discipline having is very important, especially when you work physically, making art. You know, you're sitting down for long periods of time where you're moving things. But not just physically. It really helps me to think about some of the ideas on some of the works that I'm thinking about. So it's for me, it's a release. I like that. Ritual of getting out every day to do exercise helps me to think about things and gets me prepared for the day. I mean, I have breakfast. Sometimes I don't have breakfast. Sometimes I have breakfast at lunchtime. Depends what I'm working on, sometimes I'm on the computer all day because I'm, you know, communicating with curators, trying to organize work for shows, updating my website. It could be a myriad things, but I do try to incorporate exercise because I think that really helps my artistic practice, keeps me balanced, and helps me to work through ideas if I'm stuck on something. So it kind of begins with exercise in some way, or it ends with exercise in some way. So I'm, you know, I go in, maybe I'm working on something, maybe I'm working on a combination of things. It depends.
That's impressive. I like that.
It is impressive.
Exercise is very important.
It is.
I like to try to
exercise. And it sounds like it helps you get into the zone, I guess.
It does. You know, you have to be, when you start to work by yourself as an artist, you have to be disciplined. So I think, you know, when you have the structure of exercise around what could be very an unstructured activity, it really helps, you know? You know, because sports are important to me. I like the structure of sports to go out and do stuff like that and then come back to work.
That's pretty ideal,
Yeah, so I mean, you asked me what a typical day. It really just depends on what I'm working on. I could be building a piece. I could be usually I'm different phases. Like right now, well, I'll give you an example of what I'm working on now. How's that?
Okay.
So right now I'm working on a number of things. I'm actually working on an installation called Whirl. That's where I'm going to be artist in residence at the University of Hawaii at Manoa in the fall, coming up soon. And what Whirl is I screwed together book forms that looked a little bit like a tree whorl, and I ended up putting it inside a tree as a piece of outside installation work. And what happened was that over time, within about a year, the sculpture changed completely and was transformed completely by nature and insects. And when I took it out of the tree, it actually kind of petrified into this. It almost became like a log, but it was like a cultural log that still had all the remnants of the text in it. And termite spit had kind of created an encasing around the book structure. So it came out sort of like this fabulous thing. So I decided that I would take this concept and do an installation. I was invited to an installation on the property at UH, in which I'll be taking these forms and put them into these old monkey pod tree stumps, and we'll have them sit there for about a year using nature to change them, alter them, and something wonderful will come out of that.
Absolutely.
That should be very interesting.
Well, if nature's involved, I'm not surprised.
I'm interested in, you know, that has been something that's always been in my work, this sense of trying to explore nature and attrition, you know, that happens naturally. I'm very interested in that, what it means, conceptually, and also physically, the pieces, you know, visually, they're beautiful and so interesting and strange. And again, it's abstracting something that we know as a cultural artifact and putting it out there. And kind of what happens is that, you know, you have these sort of iconic vessels of culture, knowledge, and classification systems. And what I'm doing is that I'm returning them to their botanical origins, and they get gradually subsumed by nature. So you kind of see how time and changing weather conditions and insect activity affect the narrative of the original work in a really interesting way, which is kind of like, that is so, you know, cool. A metaphor for everything, really.
Totally. So cyclical. Working on that. Yeah, that's beautiful. You'll have to send us pictures of that. Do you have any?
I will. I'm just in the first phases. We sourced some amazingly beautifully gnarled old monkey pod stumps that have their own history. We just sort of relocated them to the site. I've been working on visuals on that, working on the forms for that, just working on, you know, it takes coordination to move things that are bigger. These are, you know, 8 feet by 3 feet, 6 feet,
and
so forth.
Oh, they're big.
Yeah, so it's sort of like, you know, coordinating that is something that's a little bit different.
Yeah.
And then also, I'm also returning to work that I did in 2007, in which I was really interested in making paint sculptural, three-dimensional.
Oh, okay. That's something.
So, back in 2007, I was working with paint layers and constructing them into forms that would stand up three-dimensionally. So I'm starting to, I've been actually making these very large-scale paint skins. So to sort of explain that very briefly, most of us, when we think about paint, we think about painting on a canvas.
Sure.
I'm interested on removing the substrate altogether and try to make it three-dimensional. So taking a
just the paint,
a material that we normally associate historically with a certain context, and storyline, and doing something different with it.
Nice.
So I'm you know, I'm down in my garage area, working on making these very large scale paint skins that are going to be built into forms or added into forms. So I'm doing that, you know, on top of, you know, working also on developing some more actual book sculptures. So I'm very, very busy.
I like your thinking. You like to challenge the conventional norms of these
things. Yes, I do.
Yeah. Which is nice. I like that. Like the idea of doing, you know, paint as its own thing and not, you know, married to the canvas is completely new. You know, I mean, that would be really fascinating. I'd love to see any pictures you have of that. If you could send us down the road.
On my website, I have it's under studio. I talk a little bit about my process, and I actually have some pictures from there because I had originally taken them off because I'm actually going through a website upheaval. I'm going to be changing my website and actually adding on works that a lot of people haven't seen. But if you go under studio and you scroll down, you'll see some of these sculptures that are made out of paint.
Oh, I see. Yes. Okay. Wow.
So actually, like I took a cube, I made a cube of paint and then I framed it three-dimensionally. But I actually stopped working on this work because I didn't want to do just what I call zombie formalism, which you'll see a lot of in the art world where people are just taking something and making it look abstract and it looks cool and it sells and it doesn't really have a narrative there other than sort of what we've seen before. So I sort of abandoned that work because I wanted something that was more meaningful, like my work with the books. But I've returned to it.
You should. It looks great. Is that yellow one that kind of looks like a spine, is that paint?
Yes, it's all paint. Yeah. That was actually paint standing up.
That the looks piece amazing. Called Ripple.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yellow.
The colors.
That was about 5 feet of paint.
Yeah. Girl, you have got some skills. It's all so beautiful. Yeah. I just love the look of your work. And it's just amazing. It's really, really the texture. It's so earthy. The colors. Really nice. Really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do think, you know, environment living here in Hawaii, it's so visual. You know, you have the big island with all the lava and so forth. I think we have a lot of textures here and colors that definitely you can see that in the work. Absolutely.
Brilliant. It's a brilliant. All right. Now, I know we're running out of time a bit. So we are going to go to our concluding questions. Now, we sent you these questions in advance. Yes, you have them to give you some time to think about the answer. Because I know that these ones, we found that if we spring them on people. They're like, I don't know.
You mean I have to think of my feet? Okay.
Well, I know, right? I know you can, but sometimes I think it helps because we like to know, you know, what a genuine sort of thoughtful question answer would be to the question. So are you ready?
Okay, yes.
Okay, first, your crystal ball moment. What would your life look like? Sorry, I'm reading this wrong. What would you like your life to look like? That's a lot of L's. 5 years from now, 5 to 10 years from now, what does it look like to you?
5 years from now. Well, I mean, obviously, I hope to be making even more meaningful bodies of work. I think I would like to do more collaborative work or larger scale installation pieces in some ways.
Okay.
I would like to be participating or doing workshops, maybe internationally. I really would like that.
Mm-hmm. Workshops.
5 years. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think also I'd also would like to find a gallery that really sort of gets what I do, you know. So I'd hope in 5 years' time I would have a gallery that sort of really supports my way of thinking about things. Perhaps a nonprofit gallery. I'm not quite sure exactly where I would fit with that, but it would be nice to have that kind of support outside of the islands, because I do show up, you know, outside of the islands a lot. I think there's definitely a couple of projects that are larger scale that I would like to see realized. Okay. Yes.
Okay. Two.
Your billboard moment. If you had to print one word or statement on a billboard on a major highway, just, you know, so that a lot of people can see, what would it be?
That's a hard one. One word. It's hard to say just one word.
Well, it could be a phrase. It could be a phrase.
I don't know. Keep going. Keep pushing. Mm-hmm. Persist. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a hard one.
Okay.
Is that the hashtag question?
No, that's coming next.
Okay. Okay, the billboard moment. Yeah, okay, the hashtag. Yeah, those are kind of challenging questions.
That's why we like them.
I guess I would just say keep going, you know?
Yeah,
persist. Keep going. You have to be very persistent. Don't lose the spark. I think you have to have a certain spark to continue doing what you do and just keep it alive.
It's a good sort of attitude to have, I think, especially being creative, being an artist and whatnot. I mean, it's we, like you said, in life and in our own work and in your work and Roger's work, we all go through ups and downs
totally.
With it. Oh, and there's definitely, I don't know about you, but there's definitely times where you just kind of want to just throw it all in, you know? And you know, I think that's a really good attitude to go by, so to live by.
And now... Yep, your hashtag. If you had a hashtag, what would you love to hashtag? I think I know what that word will be.
Oh, really? Oh, I think I'd like to hear what you think.
I think it should be hashtag persistence, but we've already.
Okay, well, there you go. Yeah. I guess it would be.
But let me answer for you, sorry.
I do my own social media, and just recently, about a year ago, I started branching outside of Facebook and using hashtags for the first time, which is kind of funny. Mm-hmm. And I know that a hashtag is sort of like this phrase where people can find, you know, ideas about things and so forth.
Yeah.
And actually, when I hashtag, when I do updates of my work, sometimes I like to invent my own hashtag that when people come to it, they find nothing except just the idea.
Yes.
Yeah. So I actually like the conceptual hashtag where you can't find anything but just that one thought. Right. So, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm kind of like not going to be using hashtags in the same way other people would be.
No, absolutely.
I understand that.
What's an example you that you've used?
That hashtag idea, you know, it all actually made me think about a word that my father used to say to me. If, you know, you ask for like a one word hashtag and one thing that my father used to say to me when I was very little, and he didn't say it to anybody else in my family, just to me. He used to say I was very abrigulcious.
Abrigulcious?
I was very abrigulcious. And for years, you know, I knew I understood what the word Abergulchus meant, because mm-hmm. it was always when I was doing something sort of sassy or smart or creative or mm-hmm. witty, mm-hmm. you know, that I intuitively knew what Abergulchus was. So I always kind of think if I really had a hashtag would be I'm very Abergulchus.
Go
find that space. Yeah. For years I thought it was an actual word until when my father died, I thought about that word and I thought, you know, I never actually looked it up in the dictionary. I went to look it up and I discovered that there's actually no such thing as the word Abergulchus.
Abergulchus. So would that be T-I-O-S ending?
I just even made up my own word, the spelling of it. A-B-R-I-G-U-L-C-H-I-S-U-S. It's not, the word doesn't exist.
Wait, right. spell it for us though. A-B.
It was a word that he used to say. He said, I'm very Abergulchus.
Yeah, but how would you spell it?
I spelled it like, I think, A-B-R-I-G-U-L-C-H-I-S or U-S. I don't think I even really thought about how to spell it, but okay. Abergulchus.
Okay. Mm. Wow. Okay. That's going to be a new word.
That is a new one.
It's a new word.
It's going to go viral, that one.
That would be it, right?
yeah, absolutely.
That's
and that's to mean cheeky and creative and sassy.
Yeah, I mean, I just understood it as being something as being uniquely creative. Mm-hmm. I think it was mm-hmm. his way of saying I was special.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's what it sounds like to me.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it didn't need to be defined. It's like I knew what it meant as a child. I fantasized that I knew what it meant.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very Abergulchus. And mm-hmm. so I often think about that word and I was just like, it doesn't actually exist. And I get kind of, you know, I get a little kick out of the fact that he even made that word up to describe me.
That is so cool.
That's your own word. Mm. That is Jacqueline's
word.
My own
word, yeah.
That's wonderful. I love that. It's a great way to end it.
I know. It's kind of a cute story, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Very. We love stories like that. Okay. Yeah. Last one.
Last one. Song. If you had a theme song for your life. Another hard one. Mm-hmm. What would it be?
I struggled with this. Mm. This is hard. So, you know, it takes really no introduction, but you know the one that I chose. I won't say what it is. I'm sure you'll just play it out, right? Mm-hmm. For me, I just had to be very tongue-in-cheek about it, and that's all I'm going to say.
Well, we don't know what that song is. Did you tell us?
I told you.
Did you? When? Uh-huh. When did you tell us?
Well, it's a Chrissy Hynde song by the Pretenders, Brass and Pocket.
Brass and
Pocket. And it has a refraining chorus.
Oh, I do remember. Did you tell us the last time we tried to Skype?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was like months ago. God, my memory is like a sieve, honey.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, Brass and Pocket by the Pretenders.
Yes.
Cool.
Okay. All right. Well.
And it's mostly the chorus, I think, which is a little tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
Okay. If I was to walk into a room and that was sort of like my little song to enter the room. I mean, if you have a song that introduces you have to be sort of tongue-in-cheek about it, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so, if you want to be.
Yeah,
it's more fun that way, that's for sure. Yeah. All right, well, we got it. Right.
Yes. Thank you so much, Jacqueline. It's been
such
a pleasure.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, cheers.
All enjoy your
afternoon.
Bye.
Special. This podcast is brought to you by Rode Microphones. For professional sounding audio, please visit Rode.com. And for great quality sound effects, visit smackheads.com. This show is produced by Rajay Augustin and myself, Linda Orme. Please feel free to leave a review on iTunes and head to our website, therightspaceshow.com, for show notes. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, that's @therightspace, like us on Facebook, and check out our gallery of photos on Instagram. Thanks for joining us. So we fly through the sky as we drive, getting high.